Hello, welcome to another episode of the Valhalla Movement Podcast. We've got a very special guest, a guest who I've known for a long time now. I think it goes back to like maybe, 2005 or something, where I had met you in a biotechnology class or something like that.
Probably, yeah.
Yeah. So his name is Kartik. He is a kind of a outside member of Valhalla, and he's kind of been part of the discussions and kind of seen it grow from the grassroots to kind of where it is today. And Kartik is probably one of the smartest men I know. And I'm totally serious about that. Like he is definitely one of the most academically smart, just knows things about everything. He's very scientific, I don't know. There's something about you that speaks to me. And that really tells me that you know what you're talking about. And he's embarked in many endeavors, and he's basically turned into, amongst many other things, a expert in conflict resolution. So, hey, Kartik, thanks for being here, and man, thank you for being a part of this podcast.
Thanks a lot, Mark, and I just want to say up front, it's very flattering and embarrassing you to introduce me like that. I hope I can live up to that characterization throughout this podcast. And you're right. Well, one of the things I'm really looking at right now in a big way is this idea of conflict resolution. Mm-hmm. And you know, in retrospect, we often, you know, we always say hindsight's 20/20, and we usually think that our paths to where we end up were ordained, or you know, it couldn't have happened any other way. That journey for me was probably wrought more in contradiction and a lot of U-turns and curves more than it was a straight path. That's for sure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean it's life and all these things, and then the way that we come to being the person that we become and learning the skills that we become. You know, if you told me 5 years ago that I'd be running a nonprofit called Valhalla to try and build eco homes, I'd be like, no, you're freaking crazy. I'm going to be an entrepreneur and doing marketing and that kind of stuff. I am doing that. I'm in a marketing kind of office, right, and web office right now. But the, you know, how we come to doing these things, you know, we're moved by certain forces in the world and things that are around us. And I always say that the smarter you are, sometimes the more depressed you are, and the more you feel like you have to take on to change the world around you. And I personally know you, so I know that you kind of come about some of this kind of stuff based on your knowledge of the current state of the environment. Is that right?
Yeah, I mean, you're absolutely right, Mark. You know, I first heard of climate change when I was 13. And at that point, that term, this idea of sustainability, was really, it was on the cusp of becoming a buzzword. And now, it's come to a point where every sector and every industry and every discipline has sort of co-opted sustainability for their own purposes. And climate change is a term in our common vocabulary. When I heard about climate change, it was in a very academic, scientific setting, and that speaks to my upbringing. I come from a family of scientists. My parents, my sister, they're all in medical research, and my dad handed me this article, and he said, "What do you think?" And at that point, it wasn't so much the science that that might have piqued my interest. It was a very simple idea. It was this idea that everything else we do in the planet, everything else that we fight for, means nothing if you can't live on a planet. And I didn't analyze that idea in depth when I was 13. Of course, what I've come to realize about that is, it's such an absurd assumption. We never think to start off an article or a scientific project saying, let's assume first that the Earth is inhabitable. Then let's talk about cancer, or then let's talk about poverty, because that assumption is so absurd. And yet climate change was challenging that idea. It was challenging the reality of the planet as being fit for humans, or as being fit for many species. And because I come from a scientific family and a scientific background, I thought, okay, maybe the best way I can address this idea and this notion that was, keeping me up at night would be from a scientific perspective. And I dove head first. I didn't think twice because, I wanted to do science and I had all the support I needed to do science. So no one ever told me otherwise.
And he was the best at it. Just a quick note, in biotechnology class and in all like the science fairs and all these things, he killed it. Just so you know.
Well, thank you. I mean, you're right in the sense that I loved it. You know, it was very rewarding as a kid to be able to do science projects, to study renewable energy, to create things, you know, to invent things, to go and present them to your, you know, your elders and your professors who, as a kid, you know, we just want to be heard by friends. And now you had the opportunity for hundreds of people and thousands of people who actually were genuinely interested in what you wanted to say. And, you know, my hero has always been Spider-Man. And, you know, there's always that quote, with great power comes great responsibility. In 2007, I was challenged to really apply that adage to my life, because I met an environmental activist in my last year of competition at science fairs. This is when I was 17. And she was concerned that all these environmental discoveries, including my own, would not produce the benefits and the positive outcome. They wouldn't solve this idea, this problem of climate change, because the governments and society and people, they weren't aware. We didn't have the right policies. We didn't have the right laws. People were not empowered. They didn't feel capable of addressing such an enormous issue. And I didn't have an answer. You know, I was dumbfounded by that kind of a question because I'd never considered it. And it was only 3 years later that I really had to address that issue. It was in the back of my head, and it was sort of, you know, gnawing at me. And I finally worked up the courage to drop everything I knew about the world, everything I knew about science, and go into the world of environmental policy, environmental justice, and activism. And I did that when I went to India with no income in 2010. And I spent the entire summer working on environmental justice initiatives. Awesome. And I think the power of knowledge and knowing about environmental issues gives you the responsibility to pursue a way. And it challenged you to take on the responsibility to pursue a way to solve those problems, even if it means you have to be outside your comfort zone. And so for me, that was going into policy. I had no idea what I was doing. You know, my first campaign was with Greenpeace. You know, so it's one of the most active, as we say. It's well known for their I won't say extreme, but their unforgiving ways of addressing environmental issues.
Yeah, and that's what makes them popular, though. And you can't, you know.
Right, precisely. And we worked on nuclear liability laws in India, nuclear safety. And you know, I was cold calling. I was trying to get lawyers and judges to endorse the campaign, and I was being stonewalled by people, or I was being endorsed. You know, it was either or. And it was the first time that, you know, in science, you face rejection and you just try the experiment again, or you tweak the temperature or something else. In life, you face rejection and you might not get a second chance. If someone doesn't believe in the cause or doesn't believe in your message, that's it. You might not get another way to convey it. So I learned a lot about myself and how you actually get people interested about environmental issues. And I tried applying that in the second campaign that summer, which was with an environmental advocate, MC Mehta. And we were trying to get 300 hydroelectric dams withdrawn, 300 proposals withdrawn by the Indian government. They were planned on the, it's a pretty crazy number.
Absolutely.
You know, and they were planned on the Ganga, the Ganges River, which is India's most holy river. Over 800 million people worship that river. And India needs power, needs electricity. That's a known truth.
Without a doubt.
And they felt like this was the best way to do it. Let's just dam the river as many times as possible. And as a scientist and as a kid, you know, studying engineering at McGill, I thought, okay, if I present the facts, everyone's reasonable here. If I present the facts and I show them all the numbers and the figures that show that these dams are going to be really, really bad for the environment and they won't even produce as much electricity as the government says they will, everyone will jump on board and, you know, it'll be a happy ending. And I've never been more wrong in my life, you know, because in the end, the proposals were withdrawn, but it took someone to fast, you know, it took an octogenarian activist to go on a hunger strike and, you know, fight for his life for these proposals to be withdrawn. And it took the government to not recognize the science, but to recognize that people loved the river, that the river was part of Indian culture and it was part of their national heritage and their spirituality.
So appealing to another kind of it wasn't the facts and figures, it wasn't the science behind these kind of things that that empowered people to say, hey, I'm going to take action, I'm going to oppose this kind of bill or this idea. But it was more, you know, appealing to them on a different level that said, hey, you know what? Yeah, you're right. We do love this river. Why would we want to dam it up?
Precisely. And that shocked me. That was the most overwhelming experience of my life, even now, because it taught me that, you know, my goal was environmental protection. My goal wasn't renewable energy. It wasn't to invent a new fuel cell. The goal was protecting the environment. And if it meant that I needed to appeal to people with a message of love and hope and courage, then I needed to make sure I was dedicating my life to becoming as good as I possibly could in getting that message to the world. And so when I came back, I realized, okay, I'll complete my degree because, you know, I don't want to leave anything unfinished.
Of course.
But the minute I get a chance to dive headfirst into something that's more policy and ethics related, I'm going to do it. And that's what brings me to this idea of conflict resolution.
Yeah, and I mean, people think conflict resolution, they think, okay, like peace in the Middle East, or they think certain, you know, talks and things. But I mean, we have a very different idea, or I'm sure there's a lot more of a science to talking and to resolving conflict than most people would ever realistically imagine. Like, people have to understand that, you know, there's a book called Predictably Irrational, okay, which is that people are irrational human beings. We are not always rational. Even if you present all the facts and figures in the world, it doesn't matter. We'll still throw garbage out the window. We'll still, you know, smoking is bad, no problem. Whatever. That's how things happen. We are just irrational at times. But what we are rational with at times is that if you use methods like conflict resolution, which I'm going to allow you to explain in a second, if you use these kind of methods to actually change the conversation and actually kind of, it's almost like control the conversation and steer it in a way that is more positive for all parties and creates that win-win scenario versus butting heads. And you're butting heads sometimes on facts and figures, but most of the time on irrational topics and irrational sides of things and discussions. And it's just because that's the way it is. That's the culture that is around surrounding an idea. That's the culture that surrounds an issue at times. And people make decisions not because of the facts and figures, because the facts and figures are great. You could spew all the data in somebody's face all you want, but the second that person who is smoking and saying, oh, smoking kills, is diagnosed with the cancer, now all of a sudden they're like, oh, all those figures, yes, they're there, but they're not necessarily affecting the outcome of the desired or the kind of rational way of acting. But things like conflict resolution can kind of maybe bridge some of those gaps. So in your mind, what is conflict resolution and how is it applied? Like, what, you know, give me the crash course kind of quick version of what that is, because I know it's a huge topic, obviously.
Right. I mean, it's definitely an involved process. And then I think, you know, I love that you bring up those points, Mark, because you actually really hit the nail on the head with your impression of what conflict resolution is. It definitely is about creating win-win situations. And I just want to speak to that idea of, you know, rational versus irrational. Simon Sinek talks about this idea of how we make decisions. And it's funny because our decision-making processes are associated with the emotional part of our brain that actually has nothing to do with rational decision-making. So when people say they have a gut feeling about something, they're actually, they say they feel it's right or it's a gut feeling because they have no other words to express their decision-making process, which is very interesting because when I came back from India, I had in my mind that, okay, I would like to study environmental law. And I started to realize that, well, you know, law is still very adversarial. Being in a courtroom or trying to force a settlement, it doesn't allow people to get away from the facts and figures and maybe talk about how they feel, you know, or maybe talk about the impact someone has had on them. And for many people, they can't afford the courtroom or they can't trust the courtroom. So how do you get people to a table where they can talk about things that they value, create value for each other while actually preserving the relationship? And that's precisely what conflict resolution tries to do. And, you know, the organization I'm working with now is called Insight Collaborative. They're a conflict management nonprofit based in Boston. And it was, you know, that organization was founded on the idea that the best outcome in any interaction is where people can create value for each other while strengthening the relationships that matter to them the most. And they realize that we need a generation of people who are talented in these skills and who can share them with the world. And so through their fellowship program, you know, young college graduates such as you know, you and I can learn and study and practice effective negotiation around the world while being able to pursue, you know, personal development as well as, you know, related humanitarian contributions. And my understanding of conflict resolution, at least in the environmental context, is the idea, you know, if we're going to approach environmental protection from the notion that we need to harmonize with nature, then we can't rely on very adversarial, adversarial protocols or adversarial methods to get there. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's just so contradictory. It's so counterintuitive. And what conflict resolution allows you to do is to meet with the other side. You know, I would love to put a Greenpeace activist and someone from Texaco Chevron in the same room, and I, you know, I'm willing to wager that they have a lot more in common than they think they would.
Absolutely.
And peace building is all about that. It's about finding ways to collaborate where you previously thought you never could.
And it's to get them in that same room, but in the right environment. You know, what people talk about, even business entrepreneurs, and I'll bring an entrepreneur into this, is that the right business works with the right relationships to the right people, basically, and the right environment. And if you have the right environment and you create the right environment within an organization, within a business, within an idea, within whatever you're selling, you can control and basically produce the outcome that you want. And in certain businesses' cases, make money. And, you know, Valhalla's case, it's to make sustainability mainstream or these kind of things. Like, you will achieve the goals that you want if you create the right environment and the right relationships. So it's not enough to say, hey, guy from Texaco is in the room and guy from Greenpeace is in the room. The problem's going to be solved. No problem. Like, he's going to appeal to this guy's rationality and this guy's going to appeal to the other guy's rationality, and that's that. Of course not, because they're going to get in there, and without somebody kind of monitoring the conversation, they're trying to achieve that win-win scenario, making these things kind of happen and keeping the conversation on a level that is fair, that is, you know, like, that is respectful, number one, and that is, like, creating that win-win and understanding both sides from both perspectives. And having both people be fully heard without yelling at each other, without being angry, without being like, you're the pig that ruins our environment. And the other guy's like, you're the hippie that's just hugging the trees or whatever it is. Like, you know, and you're forgetting about the money and things involved in it. They both have points. They both do. And as much as I would maybe lean towards the Greenpeace guy, to be honest, the business side of me, I understand the Texaco guy too. I get it. We need to find the better solutions to these things. And that's a whole other discussion. I mean, whether there's solutions and we've talked about solar panels and them not being the greenest thing either, but whether there's solutions in wave technologies or wind, or whether there's solutions in bioreactors or whatever it is. Like, there's solutions out there. That's another story, another conversation. But conflict resolution is a big topic, and specifically in climate change. You know, I read this article recently on Vice that talked about how the NSA and hacked into the conversation that was going to go on in Copenhagen, okay? And they hacked in on the behalf of Canada, New Zealand, the United States, and the UK. And I think there was one other, what other one was it? Anyway, they hacked in based on those countries, and those countries basically knew that at the end of those talks to discuss, okay, how are they going to deal with climate change, that they had this kind of bailout package that that China and Russia and everyone would agree to.
Right.
So they basically went to the table saying, we know there's a bailout, we're not going to agree to anything, because they hacked in beforehand and created this thing. Now, clearly these climate change talks are not kind of working. China saying, hey, well, we can pollute more because US, you know, you guys had your industrial revolution, you had all your wealth, now it's our turn, we're allowed to pollute more, you guys are the ones creating all the pollution.
Right.
Or who have historically created most of the pollution. There's a serious problem here. But I know, and I'm sure that you believe this as well, that conflict resolution might help create that bridge. And I'm sure there's conflict resolution experts in some of these talks. But from your perspective, like, what's going on there? Like, why is it breaking down?
It's really interesting you bring that up. I mean, one of the trainings I attended before I, you know, sort of embarked on the international part of the fellowship was with a group of, you know, small island state negotiators and ambassadors to the UN for COP19 in Warsaw. And you know, what I realized is, you know, we had some of the most skilled negotiators there and present, and even they found it really difficult to get over, you know, some emotional issues or some sensitive topics that were preventing them from, you know, speaking to members of other countries or speaking to other delegates. And, mm-hmm. you know, at the UN, as much as I admire the principles upon which the United Nations was founded, we have to speak to this idea of complexity. And I find that, you know, when systems become overly complex, you're trying to get 192 territories or, you know, 200 countries or whatever it is to agree on one idea. Sure, we got everybody to ratify Kyoto, but at best it was a dud. At worst, it gave us a false sense of fulfillment. Mm-hmm. You know, and so when you have too many complex connections and too many people trying to agree with each other, things just fall apart. Mm-hmm. And you know, multi-party negotiations, yes, they can work in some cases, but you need to defer to, you know, one or two mediators, which in the UN, no state is willing to do that because you know, they don't want to give up their sovereignty.
Who's the mediator?
So, right, exactly. And then
there'll be a whole conversation. There'll be a whole summit on picking the mediator.
Well, actually, you know, the Russian government delayed, you know, the talks for a long time because they couldn't agree on one item on the agenda. So, you know, to move away from that nitpicking, I want to say something that you know, the former president of the United States, Jimmy Carter, said. He was on David Letterman. You know, a number of weeks ago, and he basically said something about a bilateral emissions agreement between U.S. and China might be a shining example of how other countries will jump on board. And it's, you know, it's the simple agreements. Let's not worry about the 200 nations. If I'm the United States, if I'm Canada, let me just get one other country to agree to this. Mm-hmm. And everyone will stop their fighting and their bickering, and they'll realize, hey, while the rest of us 200 nations were trying to figure out this one document, these guys already got something signed and they're applying it. Mm-hmm. So I think we have to pursue simplicity. And I think conflict resolution, any mediator worth their salt will understand that, you know, the simplest solution is usually the most effective.
Yeah. I mean, if you're going to the simplest solution, then the simplest solution might not yield the full results of what we want to do and what we want to change. But trying to take one giant leap, but failing every single time, is worse than taking a small step in the right direction and then seeing the progress that happens on both sides of the conversation and then allowing that conversation to go. Like,
precisely,
you know, the gap between where we need to be, which is, like, let's say here, and where we are today, which is here. Okay, climate change is a serious problem. We need to fix it. We need to address it. But if we're going to try and take that leap and be like, you know what, you know, we're all just going to stop emitting tomorrow and try and like create this thing that, you know, it's not going to be part of the solution. We need to find a way that says, okay, well, we're going to be from here to here. And that's, you know, Kyoto tried that. The conversation, I think it was good. Like, I think it's good that the conversation actually happens. Okay, whether it's a dud or whether it actually, and you made an interesting point, which I hadn't really thought about, that it actually, it almost like demoralizes the conversation of what's actually happening. It almost says like, oh shit, we tried it and it failed. Now what? Like, now where are we supposed to go? And I agree with you that making those small treaties amongst countries, like let's say Canada and US came together and said, okay, you know what? We're going to reduce our emissions down because or else we're going to have a gaping problem in this entire area and we're going to have way too much flooding in all our major cities and all that kind of stuff. And we have the power of changing that. Yet, ironically, you know, I read this another article coming, I think, from Vice or somewhere, or maybe it was Huffington Post or something like that, that basically claimed that Canada was the worst environmental country in the world. And I was just like, damn. Like, yeah, that's bad. And I believe
yeah,
it.
I mean,
and I believe
Canada
it.
Canada sort of invited the, you know, less than favorable press on its environmental record of the past.
Well, based on...
But you were saying...
Well, I mean, it's mainly the tar sands, right? Like, it's like the tar sands is like the major thing right now that's just like... sucking us into this bad situation. But it's not just the tar sands. And this is what I want to have people understand, is that climate change is a global problem. It's, you know, we're trying to address it with these big UN conferences and all these things with 200 nations. So what I was basically saying is that climate change is this big topic that we're trying to address on a global level. And it is a global problem, without a doubt. But, and we're trying, you know, we're trying to get nations together. We're trying to make all kinds of things happen on a global scale. We're trying to affect the biggest polluters and change some of the biggest things. But reality is that climate, we might say, okay, well, Canada is the worst because of, it's the tar sands, it's all Stephen Harper, and just blame him, blame him, blame him. We're bad too. Okay, individuals are part of climate change. Our individual choices, our money, we vote every day with our dollar, with our time, with our efforts, with our intention, with everything that we do, we're constantly voting in every single second of everything that we do. And if we accept part of that responsibility as human beings, as inhabitants of the planet, that say, you know, us as Canadians, as example, use up enough resources to take five worlds, that if every single human being lived like us, it would take about five worlds to basically deal with everything that we're doing in the way that we're doing it today. Not if we were changed. If we were changed, we would be more sustainable, more self-sustainable, and that's where this terminology comes in. Then we can actually change the world, and we can be a part of the policies and the things that are happening, part of the discussion. You know, to have climate change and to have the policymakers take these kind of issues more seriously and put them higher and higher up on their agendas as opposed to something else, for example, then chances are, if we're being more self-sustainable and people around us are being more self-sustainable, that our politicians are going to have to start talking about it more. They're going to have to start talking about making this sustainable change and bringing it to the forefront of their agendas and to the forefront of the change that they're trying to create. But because we're not talking about that much, and we're talking more about whether or not we should wear the hijab or whatever, or whether or not we should, you know, separate from Quebec or for Canada or whatever it is, like, because we're talking about these other things, and we're getting kind of sucked into all these conversations about certain things that are important, but not maybe as vitally important or as big as an issue as like climate change, in my opinion.
Right.
It's not happening, and so there's an individual responsibility that comes with that.
Right, and you know, I want to sort of respond to that in two ways. One, I like that you bring up this idea of blaming each other, because definitely one of the frameworks we look at in conflict resolution is how do we trick our brain, or how do we negotiate with ourselves to go from being really certain and always being sure of what's going on and who's to blame and what's right and what's wrong. How do we move from that to being a little bit more curious about how is everyone perceiving the same issue? You know, how is everyone contributing to a negative outcome? And that part of that is moving from this idea of blaming to being accountable for some of the ways we contribute to a negative outcome. That being said, I also want to speak to this idea of, you know, of climate change and us sort of being responsible, you know, society at large being sort of responsible. And I think environmentalists in some way need to be accountable for the way we're conveying this message to the world. You know, environmentalists, Bill McKibben, James Hansen, Vandana Shiva, Al Gore, they've all been ringing this alarm, right? Naomi Klein has been writing extensively about climate change, and they've been ringing the alarm since we were in the fourth grade. And we haven't moved. And why is that? My contention, and it's a little bit provocative, but my contention is that as environmentalists, we're responsible for the political inertia and for people not wanting to do anything. Why is that? Because the message has always been, you're bad and you should feel bad. Mm-hmm. You're guilty of orchestrating the largest catastrophe that the human race has ever seen, and it's everything is going to get worse. Whatever we predicted, it's going to be even worse than what we predicted. And that message of fear and gloom and doom, it's not to say that those impacts won't happen. It's not to say that that's not what we're up against. That is definitely what we're up against. Yeah. However, every successful social reform movement in the past, right from women's suffrage to civil rights to gay rights today to the peace movement in Vietnam, that was a message of love and courage and possibility and hope. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And that's how you get people rallied to your cause. And I think as environmentalists, we need to take accountability that maybe we've alienated the very group that we need to win over by shaming them and by guilt-tripping them and telling them that they need to feel bad.
I couldn't agree more. I couldn't, like, the fact that from your perspective, as somebody who's actively working in this on not only on a nonviolent communication level or on a kind of conflict resolution level, but also from even looking at policies, and I know you're going into law and this kind of stuff, environmental law, I'm assuming, and all these things. So you're totally right. We can't, in the same way that telling a smoker that what he's doing is bad and it's disgusting and blah, 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 and it's causing cancer, what we should instead say is that if you don't smoke and you just choose not to do this, you'll feel healthier, you'll feel better, you'll wake up with more energy, you'll save money. Like, if you focus on the solution and not the problem, and then you give him ways that, or the person ways of getting off smoking or replacing it with a better habit or whatever it is, because there's habits involved in it, and there's a social aspect of smoking too. You know, you're a smoker and your friend's a smoker and you guys go out for smoke breaks all the time. Now you're not going to have that thing because you don't go out for the smoke break with him. Man, it's real. It's real. There's business conversations that you have where you have a beer, you have a cigar, you have things you would never do before otherwise, but you do them because there's a social aspect to it. If we change the conversation from this is a problem to here's the solution, that to me changes. That to me is one of the biggest ways of creating actual change and of actually creating, you know, finding this conflict management and all this stuff. And it's not about here's the solution, this is what we need to do. It can't be from one party or from the other party. It can't just be the green movement or let's say Israel that says, okay, well, this is the solution, this is what it is. Okay, it can't just be the Texaco it can't be polarized neither. The solution has to come from the middle. It has to come from that win-win scenario. It has to come from that way of being more positive. And you're totally right. Us as environmentalists, our goal is to make sustainability mainstream, is to excite people, not to tear them down. Not to say everything you're doing is bad and, oh man, I can't, you think recycling is good? You recycle? Great, that's bullshit, blah, 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 and we go into all of this stuff. It's not the point. The point is that we're going to try and make it fun. We have to make it cool. We have to make it sexy. And that to me is where, like, we see certain companies and certain people doing this incredibly well, which is, I always use the example of Tesla Motors. My friend and I, Jesse and I, this guy who I do a lot of filming with and one of my good, very, very good friends, we would always laugh at the fact that all the electric cars that were coming out, okay, even though the NES battery problems and all these things, I get it, but the move is there, the intention is there. The electric cars that are coming out all look like these weird, crazy, green, like, robot-like cars, and they never look cool. And so why the hell would I want to buy that? Whereas I would totally buy the electric Mustang if it looked like a Mustang. And that's exactly what Tesla did, is that he didn't say, buy this car because everything you're driving right now is bad. He said, buy this car because it does exactly what you want to do. It's freaking sexy, plus it's environmentally friendly, or it's better for the environment than your gas guzzler. That's exactly the kind of message that appeals to who we are today. That predictably irrational person that says, I'm going to look out for myself. I still want the fast car. I still want to have the luxuries of today. And there's no way that us as Canadians or as Americans are going to throw that away. There's no way. But what I might see and might value is that maybe planting my own garden or maybe driving an electric car is more valuable to me than the other alternative, not because of just the environment, not just because of climate change or all these things, which some people aren't even fully convinced of. But because this is cool. This is the way it is. This is sexy. This is fun. This is healthy. This is good. The most successful diets programs, the most successful selling pills. Okay, they don't sell pills. You know, they don't sell Viagra by saying your dick is dysfunctional. They sell Viagra by saying, hey, you're gonna have great sex or whatever it is. They always focus on the benefits. And if we focus on the benefits as environmentalists and as people who want to make this change, and even as people who want to have peace talks in the Middle East or whatever it is, if we focus on the benefits and not solving the problem and not focusing on the issue and the problems and the bickering that goes with that, we can change it.
You're absolutely right. I mean, that's what it's one of the huge take home lessons I have from this fellowship. In September, I worked on agricultural disputes in India, where there's a strong upwelling and a dialogue on anti-GMO sentiment. And
and that's
it was
huge
funny.
In India right now, right? Like that's a big problem.
It's enormous, especially because of 250,000 farmers have committed suicide in the past 20 years or so, and
really?
A lot of that's been linked. So yes, a lot of that has been linked to BT cotton, which was promoted by the Monsanto company and Roundup, et cetera. And some people will say the jury is still out on an issue. Some people say it's a done deal, that BT Cotton was responsible. I think beyond all that was the idea that the environmentalists can use very similar rhetoric to industry professionals when they're trying to convey the same message.
Mm-hmm.
And so what I realize is you sort of need to change the narrative around that, because I personally interviewed many farmers, and a lot of them were not organic farmers because they thought it protected the environment. They were organic farmers because it was their tradition. They were organic farmers because that's what their parents taught them. They were organic farmers because it was cheaper. And so we have such a wide range of ways to meet the interests of all these people, mm-hmm. while meeting their own interests of protecting the environment. And that's something we need to focus on. And part of that, yeah, definitely is focusing on the benefits and focusing on how it meets your interests, and that's something that we're definitely working on here in the Middle East with Friends of the Earth Middle East. Their whole mandate, one of the major cornerstones of their mandate is, listen, collaborating with the Israelis is good. Even if you're a Palestinian, it's good for you as a Palestinian. If you're Jordanian, collaborating with the Palestinians is good for you as a Jordanian.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah, it'll benefit the Palestinian too. It'll benefit the Israeli. So what? What's the main take-home message? It's great for you too. Mm-hmm. So why not?
Exactly. And the fact that you focus on that solution, just bring, that's what, first of all, probably brings people to the table. It's like, okay, maybe there's a solution. Maybe we can make money. Maybe we could do whatever. Maybe we can benefit. Maybe we can, and more than just peace, because peace is good, but people like, weirdly enough, again, predictably irrational, great book. People like conflict sometimes. People like there's so many, we act so irrationally at times, but we like conflict and we like certain aspects of it, but we dislike other aspects of it. We understand that it's not good for us, and we understand that we have to come to peace, but we are unwilling to sometimes let that go. And I say, and Valhalla's message says, for back to an environmental perspective, Valhalla's message is, well, be the person, be the change you want to see. And that's super cliche and so oversaid now, but it's the truth. Because I don't know if there's ever been any truer words that have ever been spoken. Is if you act today, if you start valuing these things and you be a part of it and you learn, and you'll understand that, first of all, it's exciting. Okay, because planting your own vegetables, more than like, oh, it's the greatest vegetable I've ever had, and blah, 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 which probably it is, but it's just fun. There's something fun about it. Like and if you bring
exactly.
that fun back to it, like, and you just go out in nature and you listen to the sounds and these kind of things, like, man, it's super, like, I'm not a tree hugger. I'm not this environmental, I'm not scientific. We all have the role in this, okay? I'm not the guy who knows everything about, exactly how global warming works or all these things. Like, I get it. I do, and I've researched it, but I'm not going to be the person who's going to give you and provide you that knowledge. I'm not going to be the guy who does the study. But what I will be the guy doing is that, as I'm from a marketing perspective or an entrepreneurship perspective, is I'm going to try and change the outlook, your perception of what this is. And changing, your idea of, oh, I want to change the world, I want to benefit the society, I want to eliminate climate change, I want to save the trees, or whatever it is. Changing that away from being a hippie thing to actually being a very rational, but also even on the irrational side of things, just a fun thing. This is just fun. It's fun. It's interesting.
Definitely.
It's nice. It's a great environment. Like, wouldn't you want to have a house that instead of just grass that you have to cut, and you hate cutting the grass, so you pay other people to do it? Wouldn't you rather have like maybe a food forest or something going on? Like, it's not, I'm not appealing to you. I'm not coming up to you and saying what you're doing is wrong. And people assume that about me or about others in this movement and about Valhalla at times, is that what we're saying is that what they're doing is wrong. No, I'm not saying what you're doing is wrong. Yes, I understand the consequences of what you're doing. And yes, maybe I've I have personally, like, I just can't do some of these things anymore. Like, there's certain things that just are driving me nuts, and I'm not perfect at it, and I'm far from it, but at least I value it, and I'm playing my role within it. And this is the one major thing that I want to say is that conflict resolution and climate change and all these problems are not addressed by just the scientists or just the lawyers or just the peace talkers or just the politicians. But they're addressed by all of us every day by playing a role, by not spreading the negative messages of it, but spreading the positive of it. If we spread that is, you know, that this is fun and that we're and kind of sometimes try and stray away a little bit from the stereotypes because it will help your message, that will help. And I'm sure a lot of what you guys are doing is now shifting to the solutions, and I'm happy to hear that.
That's absolutely right. You know, we and I think the purpose of Insight Collaborative, especially through this fellowship program, is not only to train people like me to have the skills to, you know, move conversations to a more effective atmosphere, or to, you know, to try and negotiate agreements where everyone benefits, where we try to get to a win-win Pareto optimal situation as best as we can. A lot of it is I can provide those skills to other people. And a lot of people will say, yeah, but, you know, those skills only work in certain, you know, in certain scenarios. And the beauty is that, you know, and maybe, you know, I'll explain this by illustrating by example. We, in some of our training sessions, we ask people to come up with a list of words that you would use to describe yourself when you're most effective and the least effective as communicators. And there's a number adjectives you could use to describe yourself when you're really good communicating, really when you feel really effective. The funny thing is, no matter where we give this training, no matter where we go and whom we ask, the list is the same. Really? The words people will use to describe themselves when they're ineffective are universal. And the words they use to describe themselves when they feel like they're really communicating in the best way possible are also universal.
So what are some of these words?
People will say, I'm ineffective when I'm frustrated, when I feel threatened, when I don't feel like the other person respects me, when I don't know what's going on, and I feel really great as a communicator when I'm engaged, interested, focused, prepared, when I understand, when I believe in the cause. And the beauty of knowing that that mindset, ineffective and effective behaviors are universal, is that the skills we have and the skills that we can teach people is, if those skills can address those behaviors, that automatically means that those skills can address any interaction. And part of what you were saying of bringing the lawyer and the activist and then the farmer and the student and the policymaker together and making sure that it's, you know, it's not just one group leading the charge, everyone, is this idea that if we all had the skills and we were all aware of the mindsets that apply to all of us, then we can actually move to a situation, move to a scenario where everyone can participate, because we all know that about each other, that we have that common ground. That if we're emotional, it's for a given set of reasons. That if we're interested in something, it's for a fixed set of reasons. And that's really comforting, I think.
Yeah, that, you know, that is really comforting, actually. That's really, it provides a certain degree of hope that comes in with you know, the fact that, hey, we can find ways to find common ground, and that's where you guys are make your bread and butter, is that common ground, because it is such a universal thing to feel a certain way in a certain situation and to feel another way in a more positive situation. And
right.
I think what you guys are doing is really, 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 really interesting. So I'd like for you to speak a little bit more about some of the training you do. Where can people learn, number one, more about this? I think we should release this with a blog that kind of talks about some of these topics and you know, maybe something you can write, or maybe we can co-write or something. But where do they learn more about this information? You know, I know us at Valhalla, we're going to be hosting some kind of event with you, likely in June. Is it June we were talking? Anyway,
yeah,
at some point.
June, July, yeah.
Yeah, June or July. Anyway, the idea is that people can learn more about this, but where can they learn more about it maybe online? Where can they enroll to maybe be a part of the program that you were part of? Talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, I mean, so the organization, once again, is Insight Collaborative. And, you know, that there are a number of ways people can access these skills. I personally like Insight. You know, I want to be part of this program as soon as I saw that it existed. They want to target every demographic with these skills. It really applies to everyone, and I think that's something everyone should know, that if you were the person and you think you will have a conversation with someone between now and the next 5 years, you probably could benefit from this. If you ever wish to speak to another human in the next 5 years, you probably could benefit from this training. So it's that broad-based, and then that's what makes it so special. You can visit www.insightcollaborative.org. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of information there about the history of the organization, our founder, president, and our CEO, and all of the external consultants. The trainings we offer are really in two main skills. One is negotiating agreements, and the second one is communicating effectively. How do you discuss a really difficult topic or have a conversation that you find really challenging or difficult in the most effective way? And we do it in many ways. We do one-on-one coaching. If people feel that that's what's necessary for them, the flagship model that we have is the workshop, which is sort of like a crash course. It can be anywhere from 1 to 3 days, full time, so about 8 hours a day. And we try to achieve three main things. We try to raise people's awareness about certain mindsets that lead us to different outcomes, positive or negative. Two, we try to give people minimal theory and high level of hands-on exercises where they can learn to shift their mindsets to things that we know from experience are more helpful and more productive for them. Mm-hmm. And finally, none of that is helpful unless you can translate it into external actionable skills that they can really apply to their conversations. And that's the main crux of all of our workshops. We want to give people an objective framework for negotiating, an objective framework for how to prepare for and conduct a difficult conversation. Mm-hmm. And our workshops focus mainly on that. There's very little talking head going on. There's very little me. It's not teaching. There's very little theory. It's grounded in profound theory, but I'm sharing it with the group in an interactive way where mm-hmm. we're challenging them to take a stock case and have the conversation, within the first 4 hours of the workshop, or to negotiate a business transaction within, the first day of their training.
That's awesome. So, and I wanted to bring one thing, and I really want to highlight it mm-hmm. again, is because, probably people who are listening to this and say, well, why should I show up to the training? Why should I learn about any of this? Like, this doesn't matter. Man, doesn't matter. It matters for me. My dealing with I'm the person who's responsible with dealing with the city for the Valhalla movement. And the city and the people around the city and the neighbors and some of these things, they have some reservations about what we're doing, and they're a little bit scared. They feel like they use words like imposer, which is as if we're imposing our ideas upon the neighborhood and their kind of way of life, and we're somehow attacking their privacy or the quiet of the neighborhood. And the reality is, we're not at all. Like, we're only on the land like 2 or 3 days a week, and we're there for a couple hours, and we're not using the big heavy machinery, and we're basically gardening. Okay, like, gardening is one of the most peaceful, quiet things that you could possibly do. Like, we're not going in there and saying, hey, like, we want to build a factory and we're going to be cutting wood all day. You know what I mean? Like, we're not using table saws and all that stuff all day long. I mean, yes, we're going to use them from time to time for now because we're going to build a couple of things. But other than that, once it's established, I mean, this is an organic garden, permaculture garden. Like, this is what we're trying to do. But it's misconceived. There's messages that, there's conflict.
Precisely.
Conflict happens. If you have an idea that you want to build an internship, or you want to convince a school to take on a new program, or you want to change a policy that's happening around you, whether it be at a school or in your business or maybe the organization you work for, I mean, all of these things are applicable. These skills, these ways of talking, these ways of negotiating, these ways of being mindful of the other person's position and putting yourself truthfully in their shoes, but doing it in a way that is a little bit more kind of calculated and thought out and with proven techniques that you guys are teaching, these are going to all help. And people ask me, hey, Mark, you promote these things here and there with podcasts or whatever. Do you go through them? I'm like, yeah, actually we are. Like, Kartik is going to be sitting down with us and teaching us how to do this, teaching us how to deal with some of our neighbors, teaching us how to deal with the city in a better way. And we've had luckily I can be aware enough to understand these things before I've ever taken this kind of training, but I know, and we are, you know, this is going to benefit us. This is going to benefit anybody who's going to, and like you said, everyone's going to have a conversation in the next 5 years. This is going to benefit, even if you want to get over conflict management, conflict resolution with your girlfriend or your husband or your family or your whatever, right. Anyone.
You know, it's worked, and I like that you end with that, because I've applied these skills, not explicitly. You know, I haven't gone and, you know, told my family or, you know, told my friends or my sister that, listen, I'm going to use these skills on you now, and we're going to move the conversation to a better place so that we end up in a win-win. No, you apply them implicitly, and the key message I try to give people is, even if the other side is doing something that's difficult for you or that's ineffective, having these skills still let you move the conversation to a better place. And, you know, the reason why I'm starting with Valhalla, you know, aside from, you know, all of you being my buddies and being very dear to me and your message being very dear to me, is I find that these sorts of skills and these sorts of trainings, they seem to only be reserved for, you know, the Fortune 500s, you know, and they seem to only be those business development or management skills trainings that only the MBAs and the, you know, the iBankers and the lawyers are going to go and get. And
they're there really for a reason. Crucial, let's just say that.
precisely. And I feel like it's important that people in our field at the nonprofit level, the underdogs, the guys that can't afford this, or can't afford to pay as much as, someone in a business executive could afford to pay for this kind of coaching, that they have access to it as well. And that's Insight Collaborative's, one of their main messages is they only give trainings to the nonprofit world, Insight Collaborative. And they do that because they want people to be able to access these skills and this information without having to worry about the cost. And that's one main reason why I want to do this. The second reason is, I think that rather than rely on what I have to say, I would like everyone to make their own decision about whether they think these trainings could be valuable for them. That's really important for me too. And so starting off with Valhalla and, you know, having some of this documented and having your own thoughts on it, I think at that point, the writing will be on the wall. Mm-hmm. And then people can make a decision about, okay, you know, it seems to actually work. You know, it's not just some guy plugging it. It works, and you know, maybe I can benefit from it.
Yeah, and this is way more than a plug. I mean, you can take it from the conversation that we had. We truthfully care about this kind of stuff. Like I'm not trying to plug random shit here. Like I care about the environment. Right. I care about making a difference, and I understand and I see the benefit of how conflict resolution would absolutely change the conversation with our neighbors and with the city. And those are two people who are incredibly important. And here we are trying to create community, bond people together. And then there's a certain amount of conflict that comes back. Not everyone. There's tons of neighbors out there and they might be listening. They're great. Like there's so many people who showed so much support from around the world, from locally, from Montreal, from here, from there, from Afghanistan, from freaking Finland, whatever. Like they're everywhere. There's people everywhere showing us support. And we appreciate all of it. We appreciate all the help that people are bringing to the table. And we just know that there's certain key skills and certain key ways of having a conversation that can make a better situation for anyone out there. So, more information on when we're going to do some kind of event in collaboration with one another is definitely going to be there. We're definitely going to put out some kind of blog post that's going to have more information where they can learn about this, where they can sign up, where they can potentially book you also for a workshop, which sure, I'm assuming you're willing to do pretty much anywhere around the world or whatever. So just know that this can apply to anyone. Man, thank you, Kartik, for another great conversation. Always have a good time talking to you. Always,
of course.
There's always some enlightening, and you know, you bring things back to the forefront for me, and you bring new information and new knowledge that is always always for me provided like a degree of clarity, and it always, you know, I got to tell you this. For me, it always makes me feel less crazy. That's the people with the science mind. Yeah, no, but seriously, the people with a scientific background, with people who have more of a scholastic approach to these kind of issues, also kind of agree with the way that I and Valhalla and we are going about some of this change and going about some of these things. So I thank you very much for being here. And any links or all that stuff is all in the description for all this information.
Sure. Thanks for having me.
No problem.
Take care.